Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And mine is Philip Coppens. And today our special guest is Michael Cremo. Michael, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Philip, Kathleen, and all your listeners.
And just to give a brief introduction as to who Michael Cremo is, Michael is the person who wrote the biggest book called Forbidden Archaeology. In fact, it was so big that he re-edited it, republished it shortly afterwards into a more comprehensive format. And he has been making the case of things which are anomalous and things which do not fit from an archaeological perspective into mainframe history, really, ever since. It's been a quest which he's been going on for 15, 20 years. Michael and I have met on numerous conferences. We are also both in the Ancient Aliens series. And just yesterday, Kathleen and I, we were in the Natural History Museum, where they have this very basic timeline of 55 billion years ago, this happened, million years ago, rather, 10 million years ago, this happened. And it's all very framework. This is what you are given and what we are told. But Michael, history, our human history, the history of the Earth is far more complex, if not far older, than we are all led to believe. So how did you come to that conclusion, and what is the best evidence and your evidence, the evidence you encountered early on, which made you realize that not everything is what we are told?
Well, Philip, those are very good questions. By the way, it's very good to be speaking with you again. I think we've mostly met in Europe, but good to be talking to you on the air here. My journey has a lot to do with the way I was raised. I'm born in the United States, of course, but my father was a military officer, and that meant that our family was moving from place to place every 3 or 4 years or so within the United States and outside of the United States. And as a child growing up, that had a big influence on me. It opened my mind to the idea that there's more than one way to look at the world we live in. Now, the American way is one way, but it's not the only way or the best way. So I got exposed to a lot of different worldviews. And as I grew older, I began to understand that out of all the different worldviews that I had come in touch with, I would have to construct my own worldview, my own way of understanding life and the universe, its history. And in my travels, I had come across the Vedic culture of India, which is based on the ancient Sanskrit writings. And what they had to say made a lot of sense to me in a number of ways. But many of the things that I was learning from these ancient writings were quite different from what I had learned from my teachers in high school and university, especially about the presence of the human race. Yeah, when I was in school, when I was a student at high school and university, I accepted the standard theories of human origins, the Darwinian evolutionary explanations, which tell us the first human beings like us came into existence on this planet 100 or 200,000 years ago. And before that, there were no human beings like us. There were only more primitive ape-like human ancestors. But in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India and the writings of other ancient cultures, I learned that there have been human populations on Earth for millions and millions of years, going all the way back to the very beginnings of the history of life on Earth. So I had to think, what's really true? Is what my teachers told me true? Are these accounts of extreme human antiquity that I find in these ancient books just mythology, just fiction? So I had to think about it, and I decided to do some research. I wanted to see if archaeologists have ever found any evident that humans like us have been present for millions of years on Earth. So the first place I looked and was the textbooks. But as I went through all the textbooks, I didn't see any evidence like that. I saw only the evidence that supports the mainstream theories of human origins. But I decided, okay, I'm going to look beyond the textbooks. I'm going to look into the original scientific reports. And because of my education and background, I had a reading knowledge, not only of English, but of most of the major European languages. So I decided, okay, I'm going to look at the original archaeological reports, discoveries by professional scientists published in professional scientific literature for the past two centuries. I'm carefully going to go through all of that. And when I started going through that, I didn't really know what I would find. I thought, well, maybe I'll find nothing. And but I started finding one report, another report, then finally hundreds of reports of discoveries of human bones, human artifacts, human footprints, millions and millions of years old. And I collected them in, you know, a book called Forbidden Archaeology, which you mentioned was quite a big book, about 900 pages long. Some people call it Forbidding Archaeology because it's just, for some people, it's just too heavy to pick up, although many people do appreciate the wealth of detail and documentation that's there. So, and then I had to wonder, okay, why is it that these reports are there in the original scientific literature, but they're not there in the textbooks today? And that led me to understand there's a process of knowledge filtration that goes on in the world of science. You know, discoveries that support the dominant theories, they'll pass through this knowledge filter very easily, which means students will read about them in their textbooks. If they go to the local museum, they'll see these discoveries. But if there are discoveries that radically contradict, you know, the dominant ideas, they get filtered out, which means we don't hear very much about them. And I'll give a couple of examples from my work. And what I try to do in my work is show not only the discovery itself, which may be of a human bone, human artifact, or human footprint many millions of years old, but I also like to demonstrate how the process of knowledge filtration has worked in the case of a particular discovery. So one of the most interesting cases for me was the California gold mine discoveries. In the 19th century, gold was discovered in California, and the miners came from all over the world to get the gold, and they were digging tunnels into the sides of mountains, thousands of feet into the sides of mountains. And deep inside these tunnels, in the solid rock, the miners were finding human skeletons, they were finding human artifacts, you know, like obsidian spear points, stone mortars and pestles. And these things were all found in layers of solid rock that modern geologists tell us are over 50 million years old. And we have to keep in mind that according to the current theories, no human beings existed at that time. Human beings only came into existence 100 or 200,000 years ago. So it's really quite extraordinary. And these discoveries were reported to the scientific world by a prominent scientist, Dr. J.D. Whitney, who was the chief government geologist of California. His report was published by Harvard University in the year 1880, but we don't hear hardly anything about these discoveries today because of the process of knowledge filtration. There was another scientist living at the same time as Dr. Whitney. His name was William Holmes. He was an anthropologist at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. And he was more prominent than Whitney in the scientific world. And he said, if Dr. Whitney had understood the theory of human evolution, he would not have published that report. In other words, if the facts did not support the theory of evolution, they should not have been published just for that reason. And the facts were simply forgotten. And it's really a good example of how this knowledge filtration process works. And then a few years ago, I was a consultant for a TV documentary called The Mysterious Origins of Man, which was produced by a man named Bill Cote for NBC. And he had gotten a copy of my book, Forbidden Archaeology, and he wanted to include some of the cases in this documentary. And he interviewed me for the documentary. I appeared on it, sort of like the Ancient Alien series that we both recently appeared on. So I told him he should go to the Museum of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley, because I knew that some of the artifacts from the California gold mines are still in that museum today, although they're not shown to the public. So he went there and he asked for permission to see and film these artifacts for this documentary, but the museum officials gave him all kinds of excuses. They said, you're making a documentary for TV. You probably have a very tight deadline, and we just wouldn't have the time to find these things and bring them out for you. But then Bill Cote told them he had 6 months to do his documentary. And then they said, we have another problem. We would have to pay our staff overtime salaries to do this work. It's not part of their normal duties. And we have a very small budget, and we can't afford to do it. So Bill Cote offered to pay all the expenses, but still he was refused, and he was not able to see or film those artifacts. However, we were able to find some photographs of the artifacts that Dr. Whitney had taken in the 19th century. So we did have some images to use in the documentary, The Mysterious Origins of Man, which included not just my work, but the work of other researchers like Graham Hancock and Robert Bevall and others in the alternative history field, David Hatcher Childress, others. And it was interesting what happened when scientists who support the current theories learned that NBC was going to show this program. They tried to stop NBC from doing it. They mounted an international letter-writing campaign on the Internet among scientists to try to pressure NBC not to show the program. They weren't successful. The program was aired, and it was really quite popular, so NBC decided to air it a second time. And when these scientists learned that, they became even more upset and angry. They began another campaign to try to stop NBC from showing the program. They were writing to the president or the chairman of the General Electric Company, which owns the NBC television company, trying to pressure him into canceling the program. But that effort also failed. So then this group of scientists went to the American government, to the Federal Communications Commission, which is the agency of the government that licenses and regulates the TV industry. And they wanted the FCC to investigate NBC, censure NBC. They wanted the government to force NBC to broadcast primetime apologies for having shown the program. They wanted the government to fine NBC millions of dollars so that they would never do this again. I'm happy to say the government didn't do any of that, but I really thought it was interesting that these kinds of attempts were made to suppress this show. So it's another example of how, you know, the knowledge filtration process can operate. Sometimes it operates successfully, sometimes not. But then after that, a couple of years after that, I went back to that museum myself. And I'm a member of the World Archaeological Congress, which is the world's largest international organization of archaeologists. And I had proposed to present a paper, a report, on the California gold mine discoveries at a major international conference on archaeology organized by the World Archaeological Congress, and they accepted my proposal to present such a report. So with that acceptance letter, I was able to go back to the directors of the museum, and they finally allowed me personally to study and photograph these artifacts. They're not kept in the museum itself. They're kept in the storage building several miles from the museum, you know, under high security. And, you know, sometimes, you know, people think that this idea that there's unusual stuff in museums that's not being shown to the public is just something out of Hollywood movies. Maybe they saw the film Indiana Jones, where in the last scene they go into the basements of the Smithsonian Institution and see all this stuff down there that's not being shown to the public. So some people think that's just Hollywood, but it really is true that in quite a number of museums, they have in their collections things that they're not showing to the public that are, in fact, evidence for extreme human antiquity. So those are some of the reasons why I got into this forbidden archaeology topic, and one of the cases that I regard as really fascinating, which demonstrates not only evidence that humans were present 50 million years ago, but it also says something about the difficulties that those of us in the alternative history field can face when we try to get access to this kind of evidence and communicate it to the public.
This, your journey has been amazing, and that is an extraordinary story. And I want to touch on this idea of censorship and this idea of how much censorship is existing in these fields that the public doesn't know about. I mean, your story about the pressure that science placed upon NBC against this television program, to me, it's outrageous. It's extraordinary. So I have a two-pronged question regarding that process. First is, what evidence or what argument were the scientists using to justify this idea of censorship, which I think is ridiculous, but they had to have had something that they were putting forward if they were asking the government to intervene, if they were treating this as if it were dangerous information. So my first question is, what was their argument? And then my second question is, what are they really afraid of?
Well, their arguments were that it was irresponsible journalism to be presenting this kind of thing, which most scientists, you know, the most prestigious, most influential scientists don't accept. How could how could NBC dare to do that, present this kind of information, knowing full well that the scientific establishment doesn't accept it. That was their basic argument, that they should have the power. You know, they should have been consulted. They should have had the decision whether or not to communicate this evidence to the people. And as far as what they were really concerned about, that came out in some of the email messages they were exchanging among themselves on the internet. And I've documented all of this in a book that I put together called Forbidden Archaeology's Impact. People would often ask me, what has been the response of scientists to your work and to this whole forbidden archaeology topic? So I put together a book that documented all of the responses, and you know, responses to papers that I've published or presentations I've given at conferences or this television show. I documented all the responses. The actual text of the email messages can be found in this book, Forbidden Archaeology's Impact. So in the emails they were exchanging among themselves, they were worried about a few things. First of all, they were worried that, okay, they have, at the present moment, a government-enforced monopoly in the education system. In the education system, they are able to dictate what the students will read in their textbooks. They do have absolute control over what evidence is presented as credible. And this is, you know, the supporters of the current theories of human origins, the Darwinian theories of human origins, have in most countries a government-enforced monopoly in the education systems. Only their ideas can be taught. They're in charge of the curriculum. They're in charge of the textbooks and what goes into them. So they were very upset that millions of children would be going to school and learning one thing, and then coming home, turning on their television set, and on a prominent network like NBC, getting information that completely contradicted what they were being told in schools. And then they'd be faced with the fact that the children would be coming and asking, you know, questions of their teachers. They were very upset by this. And they were also, I learned, concerned about funding of their research, because those who are now in the dominant positions, who are in the scientific establishment, are getting billions of dollars from the government to support them in maintaining their theories and doing research that supports their theories. And they were afraid that if information that contradicted their theories was widely circulated among the public, as it was on that NBC television special, then eventually the public might start trying to get their political representatives to cut back on their funding, you know, especially funding in support of, you know, these theories of human origins. So those were some of the concerns that came out in the email messages that were being exchanged by scientists on internet discussion groups that were dealing with this topic. And as far as what their real motives are, I think it has a lot to do with power. You know, there are all kinds of power in the world. There's military power, there's economic power, there's political power, there's also intellectual power, which is a very subtle power, but a very real one. You know, if you can control people's minds, then you can very easily control what they do. It's a very real power. And we see that those who have power don't like to give it up very easily. For example, if one political party has a monopoly in the political life of a country, it doesn't want to give up its position very easily, as we see going on in the world. But similarly, if one group of scientists has a monopoly in the education system and scientific institutions, obviously it doesn't want to give up its position of power and influence very easily.
Absolutely. And just going back to one thing of forbidden archaeology and kind of going on from there, forbidden archaeology comes in at 900 pages, and it has one advantage, which is you will always find it in your bookshelves because it's so gigantic. You can never lose it. But it's also like when, I mean, it's been out there for roughly two decades, and I read it roughly two decades ago, and it... it goes on and on. That it's so much evidence. It's each page you turn, there is another example, and you go through it and you think like, oh my God, there is so much out there. You have been around for two decades, and what I like about you, Michael, is for two decades you have been, as you're doing here in this interview, continuing to remind people that there is all of this material out there. Which kind of, isn't going to go away, which isn't found by some lunatic somewhere who claims about something, whatever. It's solid evidence which has been uncovered by archaeologists or various other people doing everyday work, which they then discard and push aside and hope it'll be forgotten. And you're this constant person who keeps reminding the entire world, no, it's there, and it shouldn't go away. So you've been doing this for roughly two decades. Is there a change? Because despite the fact that the archaeological establishment continues to attack you, which is even in evidence on your Wikipedia page, which has Doc Weller all over it, you continue. You've just been telling us about the NBC documentary. Do you see a shift happening with the people, that they are beginning to understand the reality of the dogma which is being preached to them, and an openness towards the new possibilities of what the forbidden archaeology material is telling them?
Yes, I do. I think one sign of it was the Ancient Aliens show, which has aired on the History Channel, which is a major channel, without, as far as I know, any big protest, by the scientific community. Back in the days when The Mysterious Origins of Man came out, the cable television and satellite TV wasn't very well developed. There were only a few channels of communication to the public, in the United States at least. There were, three broadcast networks and one public network. So it was a lot easier for scientists to try to control the flow of information. But now there are hundreds of channels of communication, and there's the whole World Wide Web. So I think it is easier now to get this information out. It's easier for the public to access it. And another thing that I found is that even within the scientific world, it's not monolithic. There are all types of people there. One group I call the fundamentalist Darwinists, and they support the current theories, I believe, for reasons that aren't entirely scientific. It's more of an ideology for them. It's just something you cannot question. And they don't like what I'm doing. They don't want to hear what I have to say. They don't want anyone else to hear what I have to say. Sometimes they try to cancel lectures that I've been scheduled to give at universities. This happened with me a couple of years ago in Russia. And my books are now in about 20 languages, and Russian is one of them. So I've been invited many times to speak at universities all over Russia, and I have successfully done that. But in one case, at one university there, some professors had invited me to speak. This was the Tumen State University in Russia. And the day before my lecture, the president of the university canceled it because of pressure from scientists inside and outside the university who did not want me to speak there because, first of all, I was against their theory. And the professors who invited me tried to get the president of the university to change his mind, but he refused. He said, no, he can't speak here. So then they went to the local branch of the Russian Academy of Science, and they spoke to the director there, and he said, okay, Michael Kremel can speak here, and nobody will put any pressure on me to stop him. So they had buses bring students and professors from the university to the Russian Academy of Science building, and the lecture was held there. And the professors who invited me said that more people came than would have come if the lecture had been held at the university itself. So it's really a complex situation. There is that element that is very resistant to these alternative ideas that tries to stop it. But there are also others within the academic and scientific world who are a little more open-minded. At the present moment, they may be supporters of the current theories, but they're open-minded enough to be willing to listen to alternative ideas and maybe even change their own ideas. In other words, they're real scientists. So I see all kinds of evidence that, yes, some minds are opening up, but at the same time, others are remaining closed.
Yes, that seems to be kind of like the consensus view, isn't it, that some people are becoming more open-minded. Now, you're a citizen of the world. You've traveled across the world. You continue to travel across the world. You were brought up in various places of the world. At the start of our show, you were saying how this Western mindset as to how history is isn't a universal or a global constant on this planet. What has been the impact of your work in other cultures, in cultures which are more open-minded, which don't adhere so much to this very dogmatic Darwinist stance the way it is taught in Western schools? Is that more confirmation of what you already knew, or how is it?
Well, Philip, you know, it's very surprising during how widely spread, you know, these Western ideas are. And I think this is part of the legacy of the time of imperialism and colonialism, when the Western powers spread their influence all over the world. Their empires extended to Africa, to South America, North America, Asia. Practically the whole world was once dominated by, you know, these Western powers. And one thing they tried to do when they were extending their influence in those ways was to suppress the worldviews of the people they had made part of their empires. So they established education systems to train the elites in these countries in the Western ideas. And although many of these countries today have become politically independent, I think in many parts of the world, although countries have achieved some political independence, they've still got a lot of work to do to achieve intellectual or cultural independence. You know, for example, I'm inspired very much in my work by the Vedic culture of ancient India, and I've been many times to India on lecture tours. I've been invited to speak at educational institutions and cultural institutions there many times. And there is a good reception. However, the scientific and political elites in countries like that are to a large extent still under the influence of Western science. In terms of their ideas about human origins, the official doctrine of human origins that's taught in the schools all over India, in the government-supported schools, is the Darwinian theory of evolution. It includes the idea that humans like us have only existed for 100,000 or 200,000 years, even though the original sacred literatures, historical literatures of India, speak of humans being there for millions and millions of years. So many of the elite educated people in India will accept the Western ideas and regard what's found in their own historical text as mythological or fictional. And so it's a complex situation. I think in their hearts, you know, many of the people in India, for example, they have some reverence. They have some appreciation for the history that's told in their ancient text. But in terms of their practical engagement with the scientific world and the academic world, especially if they're part of it, they tend to conform to the dominant Western ideas, which I think is unfortunate. But, for example, just recently, 3 weeks ago, I was in India. I was speaking at universities and educational institutions all over the country. And in one case, I had been invited to speak at a university, and the same thing that happened in Russia happened in India. Some professors had invited me to speak at this university, but the day before the lecture, scientists in the university objected to the fact that I was going to lecture there, and they put pressure on the president or the rector of the university to cancel the lecture. At first, the president said, well, we can just say the university doesn't endorse his ideas and let him speak. But that wasn't enough, for these scientists who are supporters of the current theories of human origins. They said, no. So they put more pressure on the president of the university, and finally he just canceled the lecture. So this is what I find pretty much all over the world. We live in a global society. There's a lot of diversity there, but because I believe of the legacy of Western dominance in all parts of the world, the Western scientific ideas have become dominant in the education systems all over the world and have remained dominant, even though these countries have become politically independent.
You mentioned, and I'm so glad you did, the importance of the sacred texts and looking at some of these ancient stories. And that brings us to an element of your journey that I really wanted to ask you about. Through all of this extraordinary work that you have done, you have personally had a fascinating and rich and extraordinary spiritual journey as well. And one of my questions for you is, how did your work influence your personal journey and experiences of your spirituality? And how does spirituality help us to understand the work that you are doing?
Well, I encountered the spiritual culture of India when I was a teenager living in Europe. During my school vacations, I would travel, to different countries. I traveled to Paris and Rome. Once I on one of my vacations, I went to Stockholm, Sweden, and I was staying in a youth hostel. I was 16 or 17 years old, and I met some people who had come overland from India, some other young people, and they told me very fascinating stories about India and the spirituality there, the yoga there, the meditation, the temples and the Himalayas and the Ganges River and all of that. And I found that very fascinating. So I started looking into it myself, and I determined I want to go there also, and eventually I did. And, you know, I found a teacher. I think we all have to do this. I'm not here to push my particular brand of spirituality on anybody, but sort of like computers. There's lots of different kinds of computers, but if you've got to buy one, eventually you got to pick one that's good for you. So among all the different types of spirituality that I encountered in my journeys, and I think there are a lot of valid spiritualities, one thing I really object to is exclusive claims to truth. Only I have the truth, all others are. I really don't accept that. So I found something that worked for me, a system of yoga and meditation that works for me, that keeps me focused and centered on my purpose in life, which is, and also to understand my identity. For example, I could just identify myself as an American and set all my goals and values and just on that basis. But I came to understand that there's something more to me than that, that there's a spiritual essence inside of me, that I'm a being of pure consciousness, and not only am I a being of pure consciousness, all others are beings of pure consciousness, and we're all related on that level. We're all coming from the same source, and these other layers of identity that we have, which can be a source of division and conflict, are really superficial. So what I have found in my practice is that it really centers me where I belong in terms of my identity and purpose in this world. And I look at my work as part of my yoga, because part of the system of yoga that I practice is it's not just some postures that you sit in, but it's a way of being in the world where you take your talent or ability, whatever it is. A person may have musical talent or writing talent or scientific talent or speaking talent or any type of talent, to be a sculptor, a photographer, whatever. But there is a way that that talent can become your yoga. And that is how I look at my work. It's part of my yoga. It's not that the two things are separate, that sometimes I'm doing something spiritual and other times I'm doing something material or in terms of work or activity. To me, the two things are integrated so that my work becomes part of my yoga, part of my spirituality, part of my meditation.
Going back to the forbidden archaeology and this tangent, this area where science is gone, where should science go? Some questions, probably two. One is, you have seen all of these reports. You've seen the findings. What do you think science should do with them? And also, where do you think it will take us? What is there enough evidence from an archaeologist's point of view to actually give a coherent picture of what our real human planetary history looks like? Or do you think we still are not far enough just based on the archaeology to come up with that? And if that's not the case, do we need to rely on the myths and the legends to come up with a coherent picture at this moment in time?
Well, here's how I look at those things, Philip. I often speak to graduate students of archaeology and other earth sciences in universities. And what I tell them is they should be aware of the entire data set that is relevant to their field of study. And these students are often amazed to hear of so many discoveries that they've never even heard of before, not even to be spoken of negatively. You know what I mean? The kinds of things I'm presenting have just been totally filtered out of mainstream archaeology and anthropology. So my point to those who are in these fields is they should be aware of the entire data set related to their field of study, because something that doesn't make sense at one point in time may become relevant later in light of new discoveries. Say, for example, these California gold mine discoveries. Well, they were filtered out, you know, in the late 19th century because they didn't fit the accepted theories. And then they were just completely dropped, they not mentioned at all. What I believe they should do is they should keep all of this evidence in view as part of the total data set. And I actually respect intellectual freedom. I respect academic freedom. If the current theories make the most sense to a scientist, I think such a scientist has a perfect right to be a supporter of the current theories. What I don't think they have a right to do is to impose their ideas on everybody else, you know, through a monopoly in the education system and just keep all the other evidence out. Now, I think all the evidence should be kept in view, and then I would say it's up to each individual scientist or student to make up their minds about how to react to that evidence. And if they do it honestly, without trying to impose their ideas on others or trying to exclude alternative ideas, then I respect the decisions that they make. I would say that if all the evidence were taken into account, many people who are now students and scientists operating in the world would begin to understand the need for alternative theories. And as far as the role that the ancient wisdom traditions can play in this, I don't think it's possible to try to establish anything within the scientific world just on the basis of a statement from some ancient book. However, the ancient book may be the source of an idea that you could test by looking at physical evidence. And that's what I did. I just got an idea from the ancient Sanskrit writings of India that humans have existed for millions of years in the past. And I wouldn't expect any scientist to accept that just on the basis of a statement from some ancient book. But if there is evidence that is supportive of that statement in that ancient book, and it was the statement in the ancient book that led to the search for that evidence, then we might say, well, perhaps the wisdom that's there in various ancient cultures as expressed in the texts that have come down to us could be helpful in guiding scientific research. And in the world of science, it really doesn't matter where an idea comes from. Many scientists have been inspired by dreams. You know, there was the chemist Kekulé who was looking for the structure of the carbon molecules. And in a dream or a vision, he saw a snake made of fire biting its own tail, circular. So he from that, he got the inspiration to propose that, you know, the carbon molecule is circular in form, and actually it is. So many scientists have gotten inspiration from a lot of different sources, and those sources might include ancient books of wisdom, but what is necessary is that there be evidence that supports the idea, and the source of the idea shouldn't really matter. So that's basically how I approach, you know, that question.
Michael, you've been doing this for 20 years. It's a strong battle you are fighting. If there's one word which describes you, I would say it's unwavering, because you're always there, telling people, hey, I'm not going to go away. And that is what I like the most about you. You are extremely consistent, and you keep hacking away. But what does Michael Cremo like to see done? What is your great dream to see accomplished? And what needs to be accomplished?
What I think needs to be done, really, to change things, is to allow alternative ideas to be part of the official curriculum in the state-supported school systems. See, right now, it's possible to circulate these ideas on radio shows like this or at alternative science conferences. People can get together individually or in small groups and discuss these things and learn about them and make them part of their lives. But if we're talking about more systematic change in the whole society, then eventually, I think what needs to be done is these kinds of ideas have to be made part of the official curriculum in this state tax-supported school system, because those education systems are taking money from all the people. They're taking tax money from the whole population, and the views of the population are diverse. Okay, they're taking that money, then one group of scientists, who may be the majority at this point in time, are taking that money, hijacking the education system, and just promoting their own ideas and excluding all other ideas, which has the effect of delegitimizing those other ideas, so that when the new generation of scientists is being trained in the education system, they're taught to regard alternative ideas as somehow or other illegitimate, marginal, pseudoscience. There are a lot of different terms you could apply to it, because they're excluded from the official curriculum. So I would say if people want to start their schools using their own private money and only promote their one idea, well, that would be fine. But I think in a democratic society, democratic free societies, government has an obligation not to let one group within that society hijack the entire education system and use it to impose only their ideas on the people. I think some diversity should be there in the education systems, in the public tax-supported museums. I think diversity should be there. And here's how I think it should actually happen. But let's admit, okay, today, let's say 95% of the scientists are supporters of the current theories of human origins, the dominant evolutionary Darwinian ideas. Okay, that's a fact. Everyone knows it. But it's also a fact there are scientists and researchers who don't support that idea and who are proposing different alternatives. And everyone knows that. It's a fact. It's a matter of debate and discussion all over the world. So what I think should happen is that in the textbooks and classroom time, give the supporters of the current theory the majority of textbook pages, the majority of classroom time to promote their ideas, because they're in the majority. But the textbooks should also include, in a few pages, some percentage of the pages. That's up to negotiation, 5%, 4%, 3%. But in some percentage of the classroom time and pages of textbooks, the alternative ideas should be included and represented in a neutral, objective way, and then let students make up their minds about these things. And I think if that were done, I think more and more of them would make up their minds in a way that's supportive of the alternative ideas, And gradually, then we would see the situation within the scientific world change. But as long as these ideas, alternative ideas, are rigidly excluded from the official curriculum, that will have the effect of making them illegitimate, marginalized, out of the mainstream, not something that can be part of the official curriculum. And I think that's what needs to change, if there's going to be change on a society-wide scale. Meanwhile, I'll just continue to do what I'm doing. Like you said, I'm unwavering. I will continue to present my ideas in whatever forum I'm able to present them in.
Well, Michael, you are a true spirit revolutionary, and it was our absolute privilege to have you on our show. If you want to hear the interview with Michael again, you can go to the BBS Radio Archive, which is bbsradio.com. You can go to iTunes, where this show, as well as an entire year of our shows, is available for free. As a podcast, you can go to our website, which is thespiritrevolution.com. Until next time, from the both of us,
thank you, Michael, and the truth against the world.